You were listening to Ladies POV with Yo Amika. Let's get this show started. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, good morning, good morning. Happy Sunday. Happy Black History Month.
How about that?
Get that, you know, this is the best month. It's February.
Absolutely.
My birthday month.
I know.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, it's the best month ever. And because it's Black History Month, it's Black Excellence.
There you go.
And you are listening to Black Excellence right now.
You tell them.
So, this is Ladies POV with Yo Amika. I'm Amika, and she is
Yolanda.
And again, this is Ladies POV, powered by Anchor. You can hear us on all streaming platforms: Spotify, Apple Music, Google Play, iHeartRadio, all of them. Whichever you subscribe to, you can listen to us. Mm-hmm. So, today we have a special guest in the building.
Yes, we do. Yes.
LK Schwindig. She is a clinical psychologist. And we are so happy to have her on today because we are talking about mental health awareness. As y'all know, the show kind of came about after I was watching Aaron Hernandez's Netflix series. And, you know, we always talk about mental health and dealing with athletes anyway. And so after the Aaron Hernandez thing, then you got Delonte West and Antonio Brown acting out. You know, I just felt like we had questions and we wanted to bring somebody on who could answer those questions for us and give us some good insight to how their brains work and, you know, if CTE is really affecting them, or is it just something that maybe, you know, some trauma, childhood, or is it a combination of everything going on? Is it the pressures of sports? So we just wanted to bring her on just so she can answer those questions for us. So, okay, I'm going to give you the stage, give you the mic.
I am excited to be here. I am excited to just kind of have this conversation. I feel like it's a discussion that we tap dance around because we love sports so much, and I think we just completely forget about the person and always look at the athlete. So I'm really glad that we're having this conversation today.
I'm happy too, and I'm glad that you said that, you know, we kind of forget that they are people.
Exactly.
They are people too, and, you know, we think that they are just this athlete, they're on a pedestal, and, you know,
they're invincible.
I think they think that they're invincible also.
Absolutely. I think that just historically, if we look at even back to the Roman days when you had your athletes, gladiators, and all this stuff, you know, it's a bigger than life type of persona that we put on people in these roles, and we completely forget that they're a whole person and they need extra nurturing because we're putting so much pressure on them to do these things that really our bodies probably shouldn't be doing. So I think it's great for us to kind of talk about this and kind of peel the layers back to say, okay, what's really going on and how do we address it?
Yeah.
So give us a little background on yourself first so that everybody here knows exactly, you know.
Who I be.
Yeah. Who you are and maybe even to reach out to you as well.
Oh, sure, absolutely. So I have about 15 years experience in the behavioral health space, which is, of course, inclusive of mental health. I think sometimes we forget that mental and behavioral health are two different things. So I have about 15 years experience in the space, everything from victim advocacy for abuse victims down to neuropsychology, which is really kind of getting deep into the understanding behind the behaviors of the human brain. So I've done a little bit of everything. I'm actually currently facilitating a research project with the University of Maryland, in Maryland, and we have a little station in South Africa, and we're looking at mental health disparities and really how the differences are between what's happening here in the United States, what's happening abroad, and how do we bridge the gap, and what do we do to really address the whole person. So this is something actually I've loved since I was a kid. I've always studied people. I'm a people watcher by nature. So So yeah, I'm available actually on all platforms under LK Schwendig. If you want to get a hold of me, University of Maryland, it's the Global Mental Health and Addiction Program.
Okay.
And all my contact information is there as well.
Okay.
Fantastic.
All right.
I like that. Well, that's good. Well, you know, one of the first things that I wrote down, you know, researching it for the show and that you just mentioned is the difference between mental illness and behavioral health.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, and I found that mental illness comes under behavioral health because it's so matched up. But there are some slight differences.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think that they're so slight that we sometimes don't call them out specifically.
Okay.
So like when you're talking about mental health specifically, you're talking about the disease of the brain.
Okay.
So you're talking about the schizophrenia.
Right.
You're talking about the condition of the brain versus talking about something like anorexia or eating disorders, rather, or substance use, because those are the behaviors of the underlying issues with the brain.
Okay.
So it kind of comes all-inclusive. So the mental health part is the disease of the brain, and then the behavior health part is the behavior that's a reflection of the disease of the brain.
Okay. So with behavioral health, when somebody comes in with it, well, I don't want to say comes in with it, gets diagnosed
right.
with a behavioral condition, do you then look to see if there's a mental
issue? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that a lot of times people forget that a lot of our neuroses are everything is underlying, some form of underlying trauma. And I hate to use the word trauma now because it's so overused, and I think it's a trendy word now. But everything really is contingent upon what's going on in our brain. And I think that people don't realize, like, everything impacts our brain. Everything, the environment we grow up in, how we're raised as children, the things that we see as children, everything that we come in contact with shapes our brain and how our brain reacts to certain things around us and how we develop as individuals. So it's all definitely connected, for sure.
So when you talk about the mental, you know, it being, I wouldn't say the disease, but when the mental part of it that comes in to play, is it something that you can readily diagnose? Like you look in and you say, okay, look, I can see here, you know, I don't know, the MRI or something like this. Do you see that, or is it a more of a, you're talking to the person, you're you know, trying to figure out from what they're telling you, as opposed to, you know, looking in the brain to see if is there actual damage, I guess, you know, or is there an actual part of the brain that you could look at and say, yes, see, this is why they have these issues?
In some cases. And I think that's why we have so many challenges in the mental health space, because not everything is easily diagnosed. So from a psychology perspective, you know, we have what our Bible is, which is the DSM-5.
Right.
But a lot of us don't really like that because you can't put mental health in a box.
Right.
Because there are so many components and factors that come along with that. So sometimes, in some cases, like schizophrenia, oh my gosh, yeah, it's easy to put someone under a machine and say, oh, let's look at your brain and see if there's something going on and easily identify that. But then when you have situations where it's underlying emotional trauma, there's no way a scan is going to be able to pick that up.
Right.
And so you have to do talk therapy. You have to kind of uncover the layers in order to get to root causes, because you can't, an MRI is not going to put your emotional damage out on the screen.
I'm glad you said that, because when you were saying that, I kept saying, like, there's no way a machine can detect that. So I'm glad you said, you know, talk therapy. Because people can hide that.
Oh, absolutely.
People can hide that
absolutely.
So much.
Absolutely.
And you would never know. But I think, you know, sometimes just talking things out and, like I said, peeling those layers back definitely helps.
Oh, it definitely. I think we get so ingrained in wearing masks Mm-hmm. And this is especially for athletes. I mean, you have to take on a whole new identity mm-hmm. when you're out there on the field and be yes. a different person than you are when you're with your family. So in general, when you're talking about us as humans, you know, how many times have you heard people talk about code switching and doing all these things that we do to kind of tailor our behavior around certain people? After a while, we forget who we are. And so when you're going to therapy and you're having conversations with people, sometimes how many times has someone asked you, who are you? And it takes you a minute to kind of figure it out. And you kind of take a step back and you're like, well, that's a good question.
Yeah,
I don't know. Or, you know, if you're a parent, especially after a while, people say, well, what do you like? And you're like, I don't know what I like because I've always, you know, it's always been about the kids. So it's like we constantly lose our identities. So it makes it harder when we're going through emotional things because we don't know how to separate the two because we don't know the core of who we are anymore. We forget that.
I mean, but like, what are some things that we can do? Are there things that we can do to, I guess, to know who we are?
Mindfulness. So they're starting more mindfulness practices, like in schools and stuff like that. And I love that because I feel like we're always on the go so much that we never really stop to check in with ourselves. Like, how many times have you woken up in the morning and it's like robotic? You wake up, you brush your teeth, you put your clothes on, you get in the car, you know exactly how long it's going to take you to get to work.
Right.
And get there. There have been plenty of days where I get in the car and I drive, and I don't remember actually driving to where I'm going.
Right.
And that's we lose sight of simple things because we don't have mindfulness. So I think it's important for people to check in with themselves. Schedule some time for yourself to check in with yourself. Have days that are dedicated specifically to you to check in with yourself. I tell people all the time, get a therapist. And unfortunately, we're in a place where not everyone can do that. But you have like a Medicare and Medicaid and all of these insurances that are now trying to make it a lot more affordable for people to go and talk to other people, because we'll never have an objective view of ourselves. We always have to have that extra layer of objectivity, because we'll never fully be self-aware of our behaviors. So I definitely say check in with the therapist if you're able to do that, or get a group of people that will hold you accountable, accountability partners.
Uh-huh.
Definitely make a list of things that are important to you. Check in with yourself. Schedule time to check in with yourself. Ask yourself every day how you're feeling. I try to do these exercises. I do it on social media a lot, where I ask people, like, what do you need? What non-material thing do you need in this moment? Because it gives people an opportunity to really stop and say, okay, well, what is it that I do need? Like, check in with yourself. Like,
I'm asking myself that question right now. What do I need in this moment?
And write it down. I've gotten in the habit of doing like sticky notes. I'm a sticky note person.
Me too.
So like every morning when I get up, I try to write down what I need for the day. Non-material thing. Not food, not coffee, like non-material thing. Do I need compassion? Do I need understanding? Do I need patience? You know, what do I need for myself, and what do I need for other people to give me? Because that's also very important.
Wow.
I mean, well, in relation to how, I mean, you see yourself, because everybody, you know, they have these things of mental health day, you know?
Yeah.
Mental health day. But, you know, when you relate it to something like, okay, I'm looking at the numbers, and I hate to try to be a numbers person, but I just
want
to
know,
but
good.
At the same time, I want to be realistic about
Absolutely.
What's really going on, because
Absolutely.
You look at, like I said, as I'm doing research, I'm looking back, and, you know, you look at how they treated mental illness, you know, way back.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's like, okay, as soon as you showed some sort of out of normal behavior, they'll put you on your own little island. So, you know, you have
Absolutely.
These mental health hospitals, and I mean, we are not far from where they used to have one right here in Glendale.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and you still see the eerie buildings over there, where, you know, and so these treatments that they were giving at that time. So then it seemed like
after you hear about those drastic things, it kind of mental health and mental illness kind of drops off. Like you don't hear about it so much. Or if there was something wrong, you're like, whatever happened to the next door neighbor's kid?
Right.
You know, they got sent away somewhere, but you didn't really know. And like I said, it really wasn't, as you mentioned before, it's not really talked about a lot.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But then now, in the past 15 to 16 years, being diagnosed or being recognized as having some sort of mental illness has risen like 30% among
Absolutely.
Americans.
Yeah.
And definitely the numbers are higher when it comes between the age groups of like 10 to 34.
Absolutely.
So I know you said mindfulness, but why such a large number? Why is it so prominent now?
And that's the thing. I think that's where the misconception comes. It's not more prominent now. It's just more talked about and more diagnosed because people are actually going to get diagnosed. Historically, in the past, like if you think about like Crownsville, for example, the asylum in Maine.
Yes.
You know, I hate using the word insane, but that's what they used to call them, insane asylums. And if you look at places like Crownsville, who historically they used to do the most horrible things to people.
Yes.
And I mean, like, overcrowding. You had people sleeping on floors and on cots and, you know, not really getting medications because you were crazy. And I'm doing air quotes. I think that it's not necessarily... So I think it's twofold. I think that it has increased because more people are being diagnosed.
Okay.
But also, I think it has increased because of the conditions of our environment have changed. And I think that that's something that people also need to take into consideration. Your environment contributes greatly to your mental health. So when we're talking about, for example, we recently did a study with children who grow up in underserved populations and the status of their mental health in comparison to children who are not exposed to gun violence or, you know, crime of any kind. And the brain development is just different. And for the longest time, you know, we've always kind of been in this place where kids in the inner city have been branded as bad kids. Oh, that's just a bad kid. Well, you're not taking into consideration their environment and how that's impacted their brain function and how they develop. And so, yes, you have kids who are angry or behavioral challenges because you have lead paint that we still have today,
right,
that kids are being exposed to that we're not diagnosing. You know, you have all of these environmental factors that are impacting their growth. Steroids in the food, poor nutrition. And we all know that your brain health and your gut are very, very connected.
Yes.
If you have poor nutrition, you're not gonna think clearly. Your mood's gonna be impacted. So I feel like we're starting to uncover the layers of all of these things, but also our environment hasn't gotten any better.
Right.
And that contributes greatly to it. So it's multi-pronged, but I think that for the most part, for the majority, I think that we're starting to see higher numbers because more people are taking it more seriously. They're doing screenings now that they didn't used to do before.
Mm-hmm.
So if I go into the emergency room or if I take my kid to nighttime pediatrics.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing screenings now for depression.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have all of the depression screenings. We have, it's called the CRAF, which is a depression screening for kids.
Mm-hmm.
All that stuff we weren't doing before. Mm-hmm. So you had all of these adolescents up to about 21, because a lot of people still see their pediatrician at 21.
Yes.
and they're not getting properly diagnosed. So in order to be included in the numbers, you have to have a formal diagnosis.
Okay, so then that leads me to, when do you know to get help? When do you know as a parent to take your child in? When do you know as an adult that you have a problem or as a friend to say, hey, you know, I think you need to go get checked out? When do you know? When do you make the distinction between a bad day and a mental health issue?
Well, it's a huge difference. So when we're talking about time, so, you know, you have chronic and you have acute. And so I think a lot of times we get into situations where, you know, it's easy to have a bad day. Mm-hmm. It's easy to have a bad week. And, yeah. and your week is just like, you know, it started off bad on a Monday and it ended bad on a Friday. And you're just like, I'm over it. But I think when you start to see patterns, mm-hmm. So for parents, for adolescents, it's so hard for adolescents because we know hormones and right. all these other factors right. that come into play. Right. But I think it's important to, one, determine how long a behavior has been going on.
Okay.
So, and two, identify abrupt change. So sometimes, you know, when we have adolescents, they change over their kids.
Yeah.
And exactly. so, you know, their mood goes from high to low and everything in between, all in like 5 seconds.
Uh-huh.
But you can start to see uh-huh. when kids are withdrawing. And so I think a huge part of this is having different conversations. So I know when I was growing up, you know, I wasn't allowed to have a bad day as a kid.
Right.
You know, our parents was like, you better get your act together.
Right.
And
right.
you gotta
yeah.
figure it out.
Exactly.
But
uh-huh.
I think now we have to be more thoughtful about having different conversations. If your child is withdrawing, if your child is, you know, one of the things we talk about a lot is when kids say, come play with me. Or, you know, or they're vying for your attention. There's something else going on. So I think that as adults, we have to start checking in with kids. And I think that's not something as a society we've ever been used to doing, because you're kids. You
right.
know, you know, kids are resilient. They'll bounce back.
And like you said, you're not allowed to have a bad day.
Right.
But I see where I work, like I see so many parents who, like I said, they don't check in with their kids.
They don't
ask their kids
no.
how their day was. Like
yeah.
a lot of parents don't.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of parents don't do that anymore.
They
you know?
Don't.
They
and
just sit them in front of the phone or the iPad, the
exactly.
tablet, whatever it is. And then that's it. There's no conversation of, mm-hmm. well, how was your day? You know, how did this go? And, you know, did you score good on that test? Or whatever
exactly.
the case is.
Yeah, and I think it's important.
They're missing that.
So we're definitely missing that. And I think it's important to not just ask your kid, how was your... Kids are always going to say fine.
Yeah.
That's the default with setting on,
right.
on that. They're always going to be fine. Ask them, what was the most exciting part of your day?
Yeah.
You know, ask
that's
them
it.
Real questions. And I get a lot... I went and did a talk at a school for teachers, because, you know, teachers are very overwhelmed now. And, you
yes.
know, it's way different.
Yes.
Way different now. And one of the things I try to let teachers know is that if you have a child that's disruptive in your class, something is going on at home. Don't assume there is no such thing as a bad kid. And,
right.
you know, I think that we have to get to this point where we're just... You know, yes, there are some kids that are picking up behaviors from their parents.
Uh-huh.
But then you know they're picking up behaviors from their parents. And their home life might not be so good.
Might not be good.
So I think it's really important. And now they're doing more with getting psychologists in schools and you know, doing all this stuff, which is phenomenal. But I think that there's still a layer that's missing. So when we're talking about, you know, how do you know,
mm-hmm.
going back to that,
mm-hmm.
look at changes in behavior, abrupt changes and long-term changes. You know, are there things that you used to, for yourself, are there things that you used to enjoy that you're finding that you don't even enjoy anymore? And that's a huge red flag, is that when you find yourself doing things that you used to love and you don't love it anymore. You know, ask yourself why. If you have that day where you feel like you can't get out of bed,
mm-hmm.
you don't want to shower, you don't want to engage, take a step back and ask yourself why. And it's always okay. There are plenty of hotlines that are out there. We have family stress lines. We have all kinds of resources for people to kind of reach out and say, hey, I'm feeling like this and I'm not quite sure what it is. And I think that we have to get out of this space of minding our business. You know, when it comes to our friends and family, you know, a lot of times we that's I'm not getting into that. That's none of my business. It
right.
is your business, because that's the person that you've identified as your friend or your family member, and you care about them.
Uh-huh.
Be okay with checking in with them. If you notice that they're withdrawing, if you notice that, you know, they're engaging in a little more risky behavior than normal,
mm-hmm.
if you notice that they have a lack of interest in things,
mm-hmm.
one of the biggest identifiers for people who are contemplating suicide is they give away a lot of their stuff. They sell a lot of things. they disconnect with things that may have once been really important to them because they're planning to
not be here anymore.
You know, so it's very small, subtle things. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, just for the everyday person, if you notice any change in behavior, definitely address it and call it out and check in with that person or even check in with yourself.
Right.
And see, if, so this is where I have, you know, going back to the athlete issue with, you know, their friends and their family and checking in. So with the whole Delonte West thing, you know, we see him, you know, he was this big basketball star from the area.
Absolutely.
And, you know, had some issues or whatever, but he was good. And just recently, he's found on the side of the road getting beat up by somebody.
Looking terrible.
Yes, looking very terrible. And then I always ask, well, where are his friends? Where is his family?
Right.
Where are they? Right. Where is his support system? Where are these people's support system? Do they have support systems?
And what makes it so bad, though, is that when that video came out, everyone started talking about him having a job. Oh, we'll give him a job. Like, that, a job is not how you resolve this. He needs help. He needs support, and not financial support. He needs to sit down with someone every day and have a conversation about what's going on in his head. And I think that when we're looking at athletes, we get into this place of, you know, you have coaches and agents and all these people who don't want to disrupt the flow. Mm-hmm. So in order for them to not disrupt the flow, we're going to say, oh, okay, we're going to go ahead and tuck you away somewhere. You know, look at Aaron Hernandez.
Yeah.
If you know, for me, that documentary was super sad. It was sad because there were so many red flags and nobody ever did anything about it. And even in the documentary itself, they kept talking about, oh, he's a wild guy. He's a wild this. He's a wild that. He's out of control. Okay, well, why do you think that is? Nobody's asking why. Everyone's just saying, oh, that's a bad guy. We're not going to deal with that. You need to deal with that. Because then look at the end result. Like, no one's checking in especially with athletes, nobody's checking in with them. And if you think about, you know, CTE is one aspect of that, but there are so many, consider having already active mental health things going on with you that are not being diagnosed, that are not being treated, and then getting CTE on top of that.
Right.
That's a powder keg. And if you think about, you know, a lot of people get their kids into sports at young ages, 8 years old.
Yeah.
8 years old. So if you're like 8 years old and then you by chance make it to the big leagues, you're what, 27, 28? That's 20 years. Mm-hmm. 20 years of getting knocked around on the field. 20 years of having the pressure of having to win all the time. Mm-hmm. And then when you're young, you have the pressure of having to win and do school. So you have to do well academically. You have to make sure you're meeting your practice. We task these children with a lot. And then they become adults who, when they have that freedom a little bit, they lash out because they don't have anyone micromanaging them like when they were kids.
Okay, so my question now is, you recognize or things are, you know, say I recognize, how do I make somebody who gets diagnosed, or finally gets diagnosed, or finally sees or talks to somebody, how do I make them feel comfortable knowing that this is what I have? We've diagnosed you as being bipolar. You've been diagnosed as being schizophrenic. How do I make you comfortable with that now? Because now you're still a part of society.
Absolutely.
How do I make you comfortable enough for you to go take a step out of this office after I tell you this? And say, you know, go out there and, you know, this is what you have. And now you have to maybe explain that to some folks. Maybe you have to, you know, I don't know, you know, well, yeah, they're not with it. You know, they have to take an hour here to do this or, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
How do you make people comfortable with the mental illness? Because when you look at the athlete, just like we said, you know, nobody's really trying to tell them anything because, again, here's this person. Not because it's part of it, you know, watching the Michael Vick 30 for 30 this past week, too.
Oh.
He said, how can I have $10 million and have my family living like this?
Yeah.
Who, his family's going to tell him, thank you. You need to settle down. You need to do.
Right.
I give you money.
Uh-huh.
I help you out.
Yeah. Right.
So how do you come up and say, hey, look, this, when you know you're getting and you need whatever you're getting.
Right. Right.
Because, you know, you wouldn't be at this level without them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm saying. So how do you tell that person, hey, look, you know, this is this, and it's okay to have this.
I think that
it's a big stigma.
Oh yeah, it's still a stigma. And even though, you know, we get into this trendy space of having conversations, we really don't have real conversations.
Right.
And so I think a couple of things to support people in these positions is to understand that you're on their time. People who are diagnosed with any form of mental or behavioral health challenges, they have to establish their own time. And I think that's hard because when we hear a family member suffering, we instantly want to, are you taking your medication? Are you doing this? Are you doing, you know, we want to micromanage them.
Right.
And we can't do that because as soon as we do that, we've kind of established a border and we've put up a barrier because they're not going to feel safe coming to us saying, I'm struggling, because they feel then like you're going to judge them
and
or you're
going to
be disappointed or something like that. Be open. I'll let them know. And for me, when I tell people, you know, when people are first diagnosed and you know, you're trying to give family support, ask them, how can I best help you? Because sometimes we have a tendency to make things about us when they're really not about us. So, you know, a family member gets diagnosed, especially if it's a child, oh, this is what I need you to do. No, it becomes about that person. That person needs to tell you what they need you to do, and you need to be receptive to doing that. A good example, and she's okay with me saying this, one of my good friends that's like a sister, she was diagnosed with DID, dissociative identity disorder, or multiple personality is what we used to call it. And you know, she had been suicidal for many years, and this has been ongoing for decades. And you know, it's very hard because you want to instantly be protective. But I always ask her, how can I best help you? Every week I check in with her. What do you need me to do for you today? What do you need me to do for you this week? And while I have to be understanding that sometimes she's not going to take her medication, sometimes she's going to do and say things that are mean and hurtful, sometimes these things are going to happen, I still have to be her safe place. And I have to make sure I'm dealing with my feelings on what that means.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Because sometimes we get frustrated. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're not going to take your medication? Don't call me when you need something because you're not doing what you're supposed to do.
Uh-huh.
We can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're instantly, again, you're putting up a barrier and a border for that person, and that person's not going to feel safe with you. And it's really important for us to understand what that means for that person. It's all different, and the one tough part about mental health is that two people can have the same disorder and it impacts them very differently.
Right.
Medication works differently.
Mm-hmm.
Like all of these therapies really, to be perfectly honest, are hit or miss.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Because they don't work the same for the same, you know, for everyone.
It's not like that.
And so as support people, we have to make sure that we let that person know that we're there, mm-hmm. we're not judging them, and we're always a safe space for them. And don't be afraid to ask them what they need, mm-hmm. and normalize it in the conversation. Don't try to, you know, put kid gloves on and baby them, because that kind of makes it worse.
Right.
Because they feel like now they're special,
right.
And they don't want to feel different than everyone else.
Okay, but along that line too, so then, when I'm asking, you know, how do you make somebody comfortable with it,
mm-hmm.
once they get the diagnosis? Because I think that if I'm reading correctly on when I, you know, the whole thing with Delonte West came out, when he was diagnosed being bipolar, he was just like, I'm not bipolar.
Oh yeah.
I'm just basketball stressing me out a little bit.
Uh-huh.
I'm a little bit depressed. I said, but I don't have this. How do I?
Well, and that's just it, though.
The doctor says, and I know that taking this medication is going to help you, but you, the person themselves, are in denial.
And that's going to happen. And it's 90% of the time, that's what happens. People don't, it's not that they don't take their diagnosis seriously, they just feel like it can't happen to them. And a lot of times it's because they've been this way all their mm-hmm. life. So for them, it's not abnormal. Mm-hmm. It's perfectly normal. I've always been like this. That doesn't mean it's healthy.
Right.
It just means you've always been that way. So I think in normalizing it for the individual, honestly, a good chunk of that is time. It takes time. I know that.
You see how low.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like.
Yeah. And the unfortunate part about all of this is that you can't force someone to be ready when they're not ready.
Right.
You know, having a level of readiness in the stages of change, it is extremely hard. It takes, for someone with substance use disorder, it'll take them 9 times to actually get help. And oftentimes, a lot of people have to overdose and almost die before it puts them in the position to feel like, okay, I do have a problem and I need to get help. And that's the unfortunate part. It's from the outside looking in. For us, it's, oh my gosh, okay, you've been diagnosed, you need to do something. For them, it's stages of change. And one of the primary stages of change is denial. And it's always going to be like that. The best thing that anyone can do, and a good doctor would do, is constantly schedule follow-ups, constantly schedule check-ins. You have more physicians now who are doing referrals. So when someone is diagnosed bipolar, schizophrenia, you know, depression, anxiety, whatever the diagnosis, there's a follow-up to that. So it's like, okay, you know, psychiatrists prescribe, psychologists talk. So if I'm going to a psychiatrist for my medication, that psychiatrist should be referring you to a psychologist that's going to do the talk piece with you, and they'll follow up with you. What a lot of people don't know is health insurance. A lot of health insurances, when you go for and you get diagnosed, they actually have a clinical team that will follow up with you for 6 months.
Wow.
To help you transition into getting in a routine for your new diagnosis. So when you go and you've been diagnosed, there's usually a little paragraph, you know, that we sign our life away every time we see a doctor. And it says, you know, I consent, I agree, and you sign it, and then you'll have people who will call you and check in with you and say, hey, you know, I'm checking in with you today. That is the most crucial part of getting newly diagnosed individuals acclimated to their new life. And the unfortunate part is the population is not always educated on that. They don't know these people exist. They don't know what the resources are. Right. So I think that's part of the challenge as well.
Yeah, because when you talk about, okay, so, you know, trying, you know, to really relate to sports, because, well, you know, health, mental health, you know, affects us all.
Absolutely.
You know, regardless of occupation, status in life. When you're in those, how do you reach those places where, because, well, I think it's on both ends. I think even if you were, you don't grow up in an inner city type of environment where there's, you know, constant chaos going on in your neighborhood, I even still think in those situations there are issues, there are mental health issues.
Yeah.
With
that. Absolutely.
You know, status. My dad makes $100,000 more dollars than your father.
Absolutely.
I mean, so I think that there are different levels.
Absolutely.
I think when it comes to those type of things too. So I mean, it's just that it's more visual for those for people growing up in unsavory type of environments.
Right.
But how do you change that? Because as you stated before, where your environment shapes.
Absolutely.
Your mental health. So how do you get that to where we're not dealing, you're not at 20, 21 and 22, usually around the age that bipolar is diagnosed. Mm-hmm. How do you change that? How do you flip that script so that we're not dealing with athletes at this point where, like you said, their parents might see this is the only way you're going to get out.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, absolutely.
Just talking to a coworker of mine, about that. You know, this is your only way out.
It's so your
now
ticket.
I'm you're getting knocked around since, you know, there's no guarantee. as we talked before, there's no guarantee that you're going to make it, because, you know, there are, just like I'm in my house telling you this, so it's next door, so it's the next door, next door, in the same neighborhood. So it's fun at first because you are all playing together, but then when it comes to the next level, you know, you're trying to do, how do you change that? How do you not
become a victim of your environment?
Because it's difficult not to.
It is. And so I think we haven't gotten there yet as a society. We just haven't. We're starting to get there with the mindfulness and the early interventions in elementary school and stuff like that. Early intervention is key.
Right.
And I think that no matter what environment you're growing up in, I think having things rooted from the beginning to the end are important. So when you're looking at, you know, when we talk about mental health and we put it in a silo.
Right.
And we don't connect it to physical health.
Right.
And so if we connected it to physical health and we treated a person like a whole person from the very beginning, from the moment that you're born, what happens? The doctor gives your mother or father a card and says, your child needs to come in for checkups every 3, 6, 9, 10, 12, blah, 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 months.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going back and forth to the doctor to get the physical checkup.
Right.
We need to incorporate the mental piece to that as well, because that is the only way. The only way we're going to be able to really be proactive in making sure that we're addressing this before it becomes a bigger issue. We're totally working reactively right now in society. We're reactive. We're not proactive in any sense. We're totally reactive because we're saying, okay, you know, this person is diagnosed at 21. Guess what? 21 is kind of too late.
Right.
Yeah.
It becomes this situation where you're constantly trying to stay 2 steps ahead, but you're really 5 steps behind.
Right.
And it's not a balance. What we can do now, I would say, is educate parents, educate the individuals, and say, okay, and start to come up with your plan. What happens when I'm stressed? What do I do when I'm stressed? What does that look like for me? You know, what is my stress plan? We don't have these conversations. And in order for us to get to a point where I'm a parent and I'm telling my 16-year-old, think about this. I'm telling my child, the only way you're going to survive in life, your ticket out of this, is to be good in sports. Do you know how much pressure that is for a child?
That's a whole lot of pressure.
That's a significant amount of pressure for a child. And whether it's not to be meant in a, you know, pressure kind of way, adults put a lot of pressure on children.
Because a kid want to perform and do their best to try to get them out of that situation.
But what comes with that? You're already starting to develop anxiety in your child. Because you've just now tasked them with saving their whole entire family. And so, boom, here comes anxiety. And guess what? Your child's not going to talk to you because they feel like if they tell you they're stressed, they tell you they have anxiety, you're going to get upset with them because the family's depending on you. So now you've just tasked this child with an adult's task of saving everyone. And that's what we do a lot in sports. And even when we're looking at, you know, it's Black History Month, we're going to talk about the Black community.
Hello.
It's what we do with our kids. We tell them, you need to do this because we're depending on you. We are depending on you. That is a lot of pressure for a child.
That is.
And I feel like for parents who are going to get their children into sports, you need to also make sure that you're providing a layer of support for them. And parents aren't doing that. You're not doing that. You're worried about their academics. You got to keep your grade up to play. You better make sure you get good grades. You better make sure you're on practice all the time. You don't have time for this. You don't have time. I can't tell you how many times I've been to a sporting event for young athletes, and they'll be on the sidelines crying. Or they'll cry before they go out onto the field. Or if they lose a game, they fly off the hinge. Nobody's addressing these things. Nobody's having these conversations. So guess what happens? Let's say they do make it. They do make it. How are they going to react? It's just going to progress. They're going to act out. I love Odell Beckham, but his behavior is ridiculous when he doesn't win.
Oh, my God.
When things don't go his way on the field, he actively acts out on the sidelines.
And we see that a lot.
It's a distraction.
Cam Newton is another one.
Absolutely.
Look at the Super Bowl. Remember the Super Bowl when they were in there, they lost. Just walks off the podium.
Yeah, it's a distraction and it's disruptive, but at the same time, nobody's pulling this dude aside saying what's really going on, because there's something else going on there that you're behaving this way because, you know, we chalk it up to bad sportsmanship. Yeah. Bad sportsmanship comes from something else. He had some form of undue pressure on him at some point in his life where he feels like if he doesn't win, it's a blow to his self-confidence. Right. And so we have to start early in addressing these things with our children, saying, okay, what happens when you don't win? What happens? And I don't believe in, you know, participation trophies at all. However,
neither does she.
I don't believe in that at all because I think it's important. I think it's important for people to lose.
Yes.
However,
we've said this before.
We have to do a better job at teaching people how to navigate the emotions that come with that. And because we're not, as they progressively get older, they're not managing their emotions well. Not to mention all the other things. So when we're talking about preventative measures and how do we prevent this from happening, we have to go back to the drawing board. And we really have to say, okay, we need to start implementing, we need to educate. Education is key. We have to educate, but also we have to start implementing strategies long before someone gets to be 21 years old.
So I have a question about, you know, again, these kids, the athletes, just regular teenagers and the young people today in social media.
Yeah.
Because that has a whole lot of, you know, impact on them, and especially with the athletes again and them lashing out, and people can, you know, people are thumb thugs and say whatever they want to say, and then you got these celebrities and athletes who, you know, they clap back.
Absolutely.
Because they're human.
Exactly.
And they have hearts, and some people think that they don't have, you know, they don't have hearts. They're not human. They're invisible because they're not. These are human beings, and you can't say what you want to say to these people on social media.
Right.
So then when people lash out, then it's, oh, well, I can't believe they did that. Well, you shouldn't have said what you said, but, you know, so how does that impact? How does that impact the mental?
Well, social media is a huge vehicle for anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. For a number of reasons, and it's because, again, you have people who are constantly critiquing other people. So you're in a position where if you already, especially if you already have some underlying insecurities, your insecurities get blown up and magnified times 20 on social media. And I think that we have to get to a place where, and I know it's not going to happen because of social media, and it's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But we have to get to a place where we are self-governing to the point where we're okay with checking out of social media. But, you know, you have parents who are limiting screen time for their kids and doing all these things, which is great. Teenagers is a little harder to manage.
Yeah.
But the unfortunate part of that is that we're seeing a lot more teenagers committing suicide.
Yes.
Because of bullying that's happening online and things that are taking place online. So it gets to this point of asking the question, okay, at what point is enough enough, and when are we going to start doing more? I think this goes back to what I said earlier and checking in on your people.
Mm-hmm.
Because social media is something that's not going to change. We can't change that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that social media is here to stay, regardless of whether it's Snapchat or Twitter or whatever it is. It's here to stay, and it's just going to evolve, and it's just going to get worse. So I think that really implementing good strategies on how to handle what happens on that platform is how we combat the things that happen as the end result.
Okay.
I'm a person that I don't necessarily believe that, I think we over-medicate our kids, and that's just my personal opinion. I think we're too quick to medicate our children. But I do believe that, you know, there is some validity to saying, okay, you know, you need something to help you with your mood. You need something that's going to help you kind of get to where you're at. Unfortunately, social media does have an impact on that. It does.
Yeah.
And that's the unfortunate part. We have to get better at figuring out how to navigate that. And that's the unfortunate part.
Right.
Well, I mean, I kind of consider... Okay, well...
No. What are you going to say?
Growing up, you know, there was the bully.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, there was.
There was the bully. In physical form, mm-hmm. there was the bully. Or bullies.
Right.
Whether it was one big one for the whole school, whether it was one on the girl's side, one on the boy's side.
Oh, yeah.
But your parents are like, you know, deal with it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right back.
Right.
Right.
I mean, and the reason why I say this is because, to me, social media is...
A bully.
A bully.
Yeah.
What others use to bully.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you do. You need to...
Yeah.
But there's you need to get better. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I have tougher skin
and
growing
that's what
up.
I'm
I have tougher skin growing up because nowadays, I mean, I think that we too much.
Coddling.
We try to put the bubble wrap around too much.
Mm-hmm.
So these kids don't know how to handle it on their own.
Exactly.
Because the first time something happens, you're running. This is happening to Johnny. Johnny's getting, Tommy is doing something to Johnny in school all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's, you know, we gotta take, so now we have rules in school to take place. If you are, you know, seen bullying, you will be suspended, or, you know, however it is.
Right.
Know,
yeah.
Whatever rules that the schools have in place.
You'll be suspended now.
And to me, that's where social media takes over. Because
now
you can't monitor what I do on social media. And it doesn't help because kids are kids.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't help kids egg stuff on.
Oh, absolutely.
I have to be friends with you.
Absolutely.
But if you're friends with them, you're coming back to tell someone.
Right.
Look what they did. Next thing you know, it's everywhere.
Yeah. Yep. But that's where we have to get back to the point of teaching resiliency.
Right.
We have to get to the point of teaching a plan. So I'll use my own kids as an example. Love you, kids. So I'll use my own kids. My youngest son had a situation with a bully in school. And, I'm very, for everyone who knows me, you know, born and raised in New York, I'm a different brand of parent. And so my whole thing is I'm not going to fight this battle for you, but I'm going to give you all the tools you need to fight it for yourself. And how you address that is going to be on you. But then we also have to figure out what the consequences are going to be after that. And so I feel like more parents need to start having those conversations. And that's not happening. And so, you know, I think that for my son in that situation, you know, I saw the kid picking on him. Didn't intervene, you know. Some people might call me a bad parent, whatever. But you know, I feel like I can't save him because I'm not going to always be there.
Exactly.
You know, I'm not going to always be there.
Yeah.
So I can't always intervene. So if I see it, I can't necessarily intervene. But guess what? When you come home, I'm going to tell you what I saw. And I'm going to ask you how you felt about it. And I'm going to ask you what you're going to do about it. I'm going to have a conversation with you. And then I'm going to leave it up to you to figure out what you need to do to better protect yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not having those conversations. Because what's going to happen is they're going to go online. Okay, kid gets suspended from school. So what? Then what?
Mm-hmm.
They're going to, like you said, video games. My son's always on the game. They're going to go online, and they're going to find him online, and they're going to do the exact same thing. I can't intervene then. Then what's going to happen? And so, you know, when you talk about having thick skin, I think generationally, resiliency has not been taught.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been taught to be resilient. You got to figure it out. You got to figure it out for yourself. Some of that's good. Some of that not so much. Some of that not so much because, you know, I think my generation, you know, I don't know how old these ladies are, but, you know, I'll be 40 next month. And so for my generation, it was very much a you figure it out on your own kind of thing, which had its positives, but it definitely had its negatives. And I think that when it comes to bullying, you know, I know me personally, I didn't have the support that I needed, and I didn't always handle things in the best way. You know, I was a lasher outer. Growing up, you know, when I was in school, I used to black out for fight. Like, literally, I would get into fights and I would black out. And I would not remember fighting. and that's how I knew I had a problem. And so, you know, being young, I didn't address it then because it was like, you know, I grew up in a household where it was, if you get in a fight, you better win. Mm-hmm. You better not come home and have lost that fight. Mm-hmm. If you're going to get in a fight and get suspended, you better have won that fight. That's how I grew up. And it wasn't until I got into my late 20s that I realized how flawed that thinking really was. Because when I started entering the workplace and I started having conflicts with people, I would resort back to that. And I'd be overly aggressive and stuff like that. So I get that our parents, you know, they did what they felt was right at that time in that era growing up. But we're in a different time now. We can't teach these kids this that way. We can't coddle them, you know, but we have to be more proactive in giving them the tools that they need to make better decisions and better choices. So if somebody's getting bullied and they're getting bullied online, your kid has to be equipped with enough supportive knowledge of themselves to know when to quit, know when to opt out, know when to go and get help because maybe it's escalating. You know, these kids these days, they kill each other in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
It escalates to violence very quickly.
You know, you have
it escalates.
So how does it, you know, how do you...
Because our society has lost touch with life because everything's online. So, you know, it's a lot of these kids, they don't know how to fight. They've never been in a physical fight.
No.
And so they don't really know what that feels like. Mm-hmm. So it's all online confrontation, words, and it goes from words to instantly I'm gonna shoot you.
Yeah.
Because that's all I know.
Yeah.
And I've never been in a fight. I don't know what that feels like.
Yeah.
And so that's why we have to make sure that we are equipping our children with enough understanding that they know what that means. You know, I'm a court advocate. I go to court all the time with these kids and they don't understand what death is. Mm-hmm. They don't have a good perception of what that means. When you go and you stab someone or shoot somebody, they know that person stabbed, that person shot, but they have lost touch with reality, what death actually means. And they don't respect it. Mm-hmm. And because they are so far disconnected from it, it doesn't mean anything to them.
Yeah,
and so it's so easy for them to do.
So we're talking about all the pressures, especially when it comes to younger persons, and even adults too. You know, adults mm-hmm. get pressured in life because you see the workplace.
Oh, adults get bullied every day.
You see the workplace fiascos that happen, or you know, tragedies that happen as well. So what is good mental health? You know what I mean, because you know, you talk about it as being an illness, a mental illness,
mm-hmm, uh-huh,
you know, something mm-hmm. that is diagnosed. So what is a good mental? What's a good state? What is being able to be in that environment, be or grow up that way, or be taught this way, or you know, have these experiences, but still come out, not necessarily on top, but still come out with it. Okay, you know, that sounds all good, but I'm just going to go ahead and, you know, live this better life or a stress-free mm-hmm. type of life. You know, what point do you, do you have to see it for yourself that, okay, this is not the way I want to do things?
Yeah.
Or is there actually a good, does anybody truly grow up without having that kind of strife that would change their way of thinking? Because, I mean, sometimes when we look at people supposedly like that, like, have you been in this world? I mean, do you not know how this works? So how do you do that?
I'm going to say that. So the one thing that I like to do is I don't like to categorize anything as good or bad. Because I think that in itself comes with its own heaviness. I like to say healthy or unhealthy. Primarily because when you say bad, it itself gives a completely different meaning to things.
Okay.
So healthy mental health and unhealthy mental health. You know, so like even when I interact with people, I tell people, you know, don't tell your friends that they have bad behavior. Tell them their behavior is unhealthy. Okay. It's concerning. Okay. You know, okay. It's unhealthy or normal. I hate the word normal. Nobody's normal. There is no normal.
Yeah.
You know, it's either healthy or it's unhealthy. But I think that when we're talking about being mentally healthy, we have to look at it as a full continuum of wellness. And it's not just mental, it's also physical.
Right.
So if I'm the ideal, there is no ideal mentally healthy person. Everyone has some form of trauma. Everyone has some underlying something, whether it looks like, whether it's drastic or it's not. Everyone has something that kind of changes them a little bit. Everyone will have that. I think what separates a lot of us is how we have been taught to handle it. And how we're taught to address it and identify it and have the conversations. I'm gonna be honest in saying that my kids have a far advantage than what I had, simply because we're implementing so many things now that are changing what mental health looks like. When you're talking about mental healthiness, we're talking about resiliency. We're talking about having the ability to go through something traumatic and kind of bounce back from that. You know, we use the word strong a lot. I don't like to use the word strong, because when I think of strong, I think of physical health.
Right.
And that's where we should keep it. we shouldn't look at someone who's going through homelessness and all of these challenges and say, oh my God, I'm so proud of you, you're so strong. You're resilient, but you're not strong. No one's unbreakable. And I think that we have to stop thinking that being in a position of being broken, it's a problem with that. It's okay to break. Everybody breaks. Everyone reaches a breaking point.
Yes.
But it's how you bounce back from that. It's your resiliency that is really going to determine how mentally healthy you are and how mentally healthy you'll continue to be. And so when we're talking about, you know, how do we, you know, there is no ideal for mental healthiness. And that's one thing I think that we have to kind of get away from, is saying, you know, what's the ideal, or what's the, you know, there is no ideal, there is no standard, because everyone's different. You know, you could have someone who has bipolar, they're taking their medications every day,
right.
You know, they haven't had a relapse in behavior, they haven't, you know, that's mentally healthy for them. Is mentally healthy for them. They're in a mentally healthy place. Why? Because they're taking their medications, they're going to their therapy appointments, they're doing all of the things that they need to do for themselves. That's mentally healthy. Mentally healthy doesn't mean without burden. Right. Mentally healthy means I'm doing the things that I need to do to protect myself. And I think that once we get to a point where we're starting to realize that, I think things will be better for other people. You know, my expectation is not that anyone, you know, I've been homeless, I've gone through all these things, and I never say, oh, well, I've been through all that, you should be fine. And we do that.
We do that.
And we tell people, that's nothing.
I can do it, you can do it too.
But like everyone's ability to be resilient is different. So what's mentally healthy for me is not going to be what's mentally healthy for you. Mentally healthy for you could be taking your anxiety medication on time every day.
Right.
That's a huge win. Mentally healthy for me is not being on medication. Not saying that your medication is wrong, but for me it doesn't work.
Right.
So mentally healthy and the ideal mental health state is whatever works, therapies work for you to make sure that you can navigate your emotions, your feelings, and resiliency in a productive way.
So pretty much there's no box.
There is no box.
There's no box for mental health.
There is no box for mental health. Absolutely not.
It's all catered to the person.
It's very individualized. And I think that once we figure that out in a broader sense and start to apply those things, it'll be a lot easier. Because I think that even for people who are bipolar, there are different levels of bipolar. It's bipolar 1, bipolar 2. People's chemical compositions are so vastly different that there's no way one person is going to take another person's medication and be totally fine, as we like to say.
Right.
It's just not going to work that way. And I think that part of being mentally healthy is identifying that. And being able to say, okay, this does not work for me, this does work for me, and this is what I need to do. And we unfortunately haven't gotten there yet as a society, but the more we have the conversations, we can get there.
Wow.
It's a lot.
Yeah, this is definitely a lot.
I think, you know, when we're talking about athletes, I think it's really important for us, I think it's important for the organizations, the NFLs, the non-professional league owners, all of these organizations that cater to sports in any sense, basketball, baseball, football, whatever it is, that they're offering an extra layer of support.
Yeah, they're starting to do that now.
That should be,
yeah, they're definitely
that,
starting to do
that
should now.
Be the standard in that, yeah. You know, and that you're not being penalized. Because a lot of these organizations, if they find out you have a mental illness, they're penalizing you, you know, on the back end. And so not penalizing that person is still able to play.
Yeah, they're still
that
able
person's
to play
still
at
able
that
to high perform.
Level. They just have that extra layer, you know, when they're off the field.
Exactly.
And, you know, something comes over them and they need to be able to deal with that off the field.
Absolutely. And I think one of the more recent cases that kind of stuck out to me, the Florida teenager, he was 17, what was his name, Bryce Gaudy.
Okay, yeah.
He was supposed to go to Georgia Tech to play football, and he was accepted, and next thing you know, he commits suicide.
Yeah.
And one of the hardest things for me in that story was, you know, his mom's recounting of that day, and him going to her saying, hey, you know, I'm struggling, and she's like, oh, you know, I have too many things I'm dealing with right now. I need you to work through this. And then a few hours later, he's gone. And so I think it's important when you're not only for student athletes, but just people in general, when people reach out to you, if people are extending the reach, make sure you're being receptive to that.
Yeah, because if they're extending that reach, then that means that they are looking for some help. They want some type of help.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, yeah, we can't not dismiss that.
Yeah, and I think...
And I think a lot of people tend to dismiss that. Like, I always tell people, if you need some help, come to me. Like, I'm a listening ear. Mm-hmm. I might be able to point you in the right direction. I can give you a little bit of something. But if you need some help, just come to me. It's okay.
Absolutely. And I think that, so I think that what happens is people come to people, excuse me, because they're dealing with their own stuff.
Uh-huh.
They may not be as receptive. One of the things that I like to do is, you know, if I'm not mentally in a place where I feel like I can take on someone else's stuff,
mm-hmm.
I always refer them to call someone. Hotlines are anonymous. You don't have to give your name. You know, you don't have to tell the person where you're calling from. You call someone who can really just sit and listen, and they will. And they'll sit and they'll listen, and they'll do whatever they can to provide you with support.
That's a good thing. Y'all hear that? Hotlines, people.
Yeah, I mean, really.
If your friends and family are not available, there's a hotline that you can call. This has been a great conversation. We are like way over, but it's fine. I didn't, you know.
Sorry, I like to talk.
No, I didn't want to stop you because we were getting some good information. I think we both learned a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it
learned
really,
a lot today.
I mean, like I said, you look at the state of things. Like you said, you know, it's different. It's a different world. It's a different place now. That, you know, we have to really start looking into a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many things now that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people just really need to pay attention. Like I said, mindfulness. I really, really like that word.
I do too.
Being mindful.
And we are, like, I work in a school and we're starting, you know, we have a mindfulness week that the counselors have started.
Yeah,
and, so you know, this is just doing different things each day for mindfulness. So I like that. And, you know, I'm going to push for us to keep that going, you know, each month.
Yeah, even if it's a short check-in with yourself and or with someone that you know, short check-ins are so important.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's a quick... You know, what are you feeling like today? I do want to give a number. It's a 24-hour. It's for parents, but anyone can really call. It's a stress line, and you don't necessarily have to be suicidal to call it. Like if you feel like you're under any kind of stress, if you feel like you're trying to navigate, or feel like you're not quite sure how to navigate some things that you're feeling, the number's 1-800-243-7337. And it's a 24-hour helpline, so you can call at any time of day. And even if it's a situation that they feel they can't handle, they'll get you connected to the appropriate resources.
Excellent. I like it.
All right. So we're going to put that number
in the description.
So if anyone needs anything after listening to this episode, if you need any type of help, call that number, or we'll reach out to us and we can get you to the right person, the right people. Because we have the resources. Thank you.
Okay,
thank you so much for this. This is great. We're so happy. Very eye-opening.
Thank you. And I hope I answered everyone. I love this talk, so I hope I answered all the questions.
It's fine. And directly. We would love to have you back on.
To continue
the conversation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, our check-in. We can have our mental check-in. Okay. Mental health check-in.
I know, that's right.
Absolutely.
Keep us on the up and up, too. But yeah, this was great.
Yeah, absolutely.
This was great, and I hope that people got something out of it.
Yes.
Because I know I did. Yeah.
Awesome.
So I'm hoping that everyone listening, I hope you guys got something out of this conversation too, and we can keep the conversation, going on our Facebook page.
Yep.
On our Twitter.
Yep.
At Ladies POV Pod is where you can find us, and that's about it. I mean, it's Super Bowl Sunday.
Yeah, we didn't get
to talk about that so much, but briefly. The Chiefs and the Chiefs and the Niners.
Chiefs and Niners.
We'll see who Yolanda and the man picks later.
Watch us later, we'll see who they have coming up later.
But
Yes.
This has been another great episode of Ladies POV.
Absolutely.
Again, LK, thank you so much.
Thank you for coming on and sharing some lights and people
for us and everything, and just providing those resources that people might need. Any final words, anyone?
I think everything has been said this morning. I really do.
I think so.
Well,
I just want to say, keep smiling, guys. Keep shining. But really, keep smiling. Get some help if you need it. And rest in peace, Kobe. I still can't believe he's saying that, but rest in peace, Kobe. My heart goes out to all the families who have lost, their loved ones in that tragedy. And that's about it. This has been another episode of Ladies POV, and we will see you next week. Happy Black History Month.
See you.
Peace.